Introduction. Sudden illnesses and medical emergencies are common in children and infants. This chapter covers the special knowledge and skills you will need to assess and treat children and infants. This chapter also covers the differences between the anatomy of an adult and a child and highlights the special considerations for examining pediatric patients. It describes how the pediatric assessment triangle gives you a first impression of the severity of the child's illness or injury. Respiratory care for children is extremely important. This chapter reviews the following respiratory skills: opening the airway, basic life support, suctioning, and relieving airway obstructions. It explains the signs of respiratory distress, respiratory failure, and circulatory failure in children and infants. It is important that you learn some basic information and treatment for the following conditions: altered mental status, asthma, croup, epiglottitis, drowning, heat illnesses, high fever, seizures, vomiting and diarrhea, abdominal pain, poisoning, and sudden infant death syndrome. Because trauma is the leading cause of death in children, this chapter covers patterns of injury and the signs of traumatic shock in children. Finally, it is important for you to be able to recognize some of the signs and symptoms of child abuse and sexual abuse of children so you can take the appropriate steps to get help from the proper authorities. General considerations. Managing a pediatric emergency can be one of the most stressful situations you face as an emergency medical responder, EMR. The child is frightened, anxious, and usually unable to communicate the problem to you clearly. The parents are anxious and frightened. In an atmosphere where everyone involved is tense, you must remain calm and behave in a controlled and professional manner. Emergency medical services, EMS personnel, often have mixed feelings when treating a child. In some situations, the child reminds them of someone they know. Even the most experienced personnel respond emotionally to a seriously ill or injured child. Unless you are prepared, your anxiety and fear may interfere with your ability to deliver proper care. The parents. The child's parents or caregivers can be either allies or a potential problem. You must respond to them as much as to the child, although in a different way. Talk to both the parents and the child as much as possible. Parents are understandably concerned about their child's condition, especially if they do not clearly understand the situation or if they think the situation is more serious than it is. For example, imagine a parent's reaction to a bleeding laceration on his or her child's forehead. You know that scalp wounds can bleed profusely, but you also know that you can easily control such bleeding with direct pressure. However, many parents are not aware of this fact and may become emotionally distressed by the large amount of blood. Other parents can be extremely helpful. They know the child well and can tell you how the child's behavior is different from his or her usual behavior. Children get many of their behavioral cues from their parents. Therefore, if you calm the parents, talk with them, and ask for their assistance in calming the child, it is likely that the child will become less agitated. It is a good idea to allow a parent to hold the child if the illness or injury permits. If the injury is such that the parent cannot hold the child on his or her lap, let the parent hold the child's hand or keep the parents where the child can see them. Quickly try to develop a rapport with the child. Tell the child your first name, find out what the child's name is, and use the child's name as you explain what you are doing. Do not stand over the child. Squat, kneel, or sit down to place yourself at the level of the child and establish eye contact. Ask the child simple questions about the pain and ask the child to help you by pointing to or touching the painful area. Be honest with the child. For example, if you must move an arm or leg to apply a splint, tell the child what you are going to do and explain that the movement may hurt. In talking to the child, you can also request his or her help, asking the child to help you by being calm, lying still, or holding a bandage. The level of understanding and cooperation you can receive from an ill or injured child is often remarkable and may surprise you. Some emergency service agencies provide the child with a trauma teddy bear to hold while being examined. Pediatric anatomy and function. Children and adults have the same body systems that perform the same functions. However, there are certain differences, particularly in the airway, that you need to understand. A child's airway is smaller in relation to the rest of the body. Therefore, secretions or swelling from illnesses or trauma can more easily block the child's airway. Because a child's tongue is relatively larger than the tongue of an adult, a child's tongue can more easily block the airway if the child becomes unresponsive. Because a child's upper airway anatomy is more flexible than that of an adult, you must remember to avoid hyperextending, overextending the neck of an infant or child when attempting to open the airway. Position the head in a neutral or slight sniffing position, but do not hyperextend the neck. Hyperextension of a child's neck can occlude the airway. For at least the first 6 months of their lives, infants can breathe only through their noses. If mucus blocks an infant's nose, the infant cannot breathe through the mouth. Therefore, it is important to clear the nose of an infant to enable breathing. When the demands on a child's respiratory system change, the child is able to quickly compensate by increasing his or her breathing rate and breathing efforts. However, these compensatory mechanisms will function for only a short period of time because the child will become exhausted. When this happens, the child may begin to show signs of severe respiratory distress and rapidly progress into respiratory failure if left untreated. Therefore, it is important for you to perform a thorough patient assessment and monitor the child's vital signs at least every 5 minutes when caring for seriously ill or injured pediatric patients. Infants and children also have limited abilities to compensate for changes in temperature when compared with adults. Children have a greater surface area relative to the mass of their body. This means that they lose relatively more heat than adults do. Therefore, you need to keep the body temperature of children as close to normal as possible and warm them if they become chilled. Examining a child. It is important for you to perform a thorough and systematic assessment of a child to determine the extent of his or her illness or injury. The examination of a child should consist of the same 5 steps used in the patient assessment sequence that you learned for adult patients. First, perform a scene size-up to ensure that the scene is safe for you and for the patient. Then complete a primary assessment to perform a general impression of the patient, to determine the patient's level of responsiveness, and to assess the status of the airway, breathing, and circulation, ABCs. Next, complete a secondary assessment by examining the child from head to toe. Obtain a medical history. Finally, perform reassessments as needed. The Pediatric Assessment Triangle. It is important for you to be able to quickly determine when a child is seriously ill or injured. The Pediatric Assessment Triangle, PAT, was developed to help you quickly form a general impression of a pediatric patient's condition as part of your primary assessment. It does not change the steps of the patient assessment sequence you already learned. The PAT is a valuable tool that allows you to quickly form a general impression of the child, using only your senses of sight and hearing. It provides you with an accurate initial picture of the functioning of the child's airway, breathing, circulation, and level of responsiveness. It will help you begin to identify whether the child is experiencing a serious condition. It will help you assess a child from a distance and determine what steps to take first. The 3 components of the PAT are 1. The child's overall appearance, 2. The work of breathing, and 3. Circulation to the skin. Each of these 3 components is discussed in this section. Appearance. The first element of the PAT is appearance. Does the child appear to be ill or injured? The child's general appearance is important when you are trying to determine the severity of the child's illness or injury. The general appearance is an indicator of how well the heart and lungs are working. Appearance is also a good indication of how well the central nervous system is working. As you assess a child, compare his or her appearance and actions with what you would expect from a healthy child of the same age. Look at the child to see whether he or she has good muscle tone. Is the child crying or able to speak? Infants and young children normally cry in response to fear or pain. A child who is not crying may have a decreased level of consciousness, an upper airway infection, or swelling in the airway. If the child is crying, does the cry sound like a normal, healthy cry, or is it a subdued whimper? Does the child have a blank, unfocused stare, or does he or she look at others? Carefully evaluate a child who is unresponsive, lackluster, and appears ill, because lack of activity and interest can signal serious illness or injury. Is the child able to interact in a manner that is age-appropriate? If the child is conscious, it is better to start your assessment from across the room than to disturb the child by removing him or her from the caregiver's arms. A child with good eye contact, good muscle tone, and good color would seem to be normal. A child who makes poor eye contact and is pale and listless should be of concern to you. As you evaluate the initial appearance of a child, Keep in mind that the child's appearance can change quickly. Therefore, you need to reassess the child's appearance regularly. Work of breathing. The second element of the PAT is the work of breathing. In children, assessing the work of breathing is a more accurate indicator of a child's condition than merely determining the rate of respirations. You can determine the child's work of breathing by measuring four factors. 1. Abnormal breath sounds. 2. Abnormal positioning. 3. Retractions of the neck or chest. And 4. Flaring of the nostrils. Abnormal breath sounds include noisy breathing, snoring, crowing, grunting, or wheezing. Abnormal positioning includes leaning forward while supporting themselves with their arms and a refusal to lie down. Retractions can occur above the collarbone or between the ribs. Flaring of the nostrils occurs during inspiration. You can perform this assessment from across the room without touching the child. Circulation to the skin. The third element of the PAT is circulation to the skin. The three characteristics for determining circulation to the skin are paleness, mottling, and cyanosis. Check the child's skin for paleness or pallor. White or pale skin indicates an inadequate blood flow to the skin. The second characteristic of circulation to the skin is mottling, a patchy skin discoloration that is caused by too little or too much circulation to the skin. The third characteristic used in assessing the skin is cyanosis. Cyanosis is a blue discoloration of the skin caused by low levels of oxygen in the blood. You can establish the status of the circulation to the skin without touching the child. Based on the findings of the PAT, you should now be able to form a general impression of a pediatric patient and determine the severity of the child's illness or injury. Use the PAT with the other parts of the patient assessment sequence that you learned in Chapter 9, Patient Assessment. This helpful tool allows you to quickly obtain valuable information without touching and agitating the child, and it helps set the priorities for further assessment and treatment. Respirations. To calculate the respiratory rate of a child, count respirations for 30 seconds and multiply by 2. Counting for less than 30 seconds can cause inaccurate results because children often have irregular breathing patterns. As you examine children, look to see how much work they are doing to breathe. This work of breathing will help to determine whether they are in respiratory distress. Look for abnormal breath sounds, such as noisy breathing, snoring, crowing, grunting, or wheezing. Look to determine whether they are holding themselves in an abnormal position. Are they supporting themselves with their arms while leaning forward, known as the tripod position, or do they refuse to lie down? Check for retractions of the neck or chest. Look for flaring of the nostrils. These signs and symptoms of breathing difficulty are the same as the ones you use to assess breathing difficulty as part of the PAT. The presence of any of these signs indicates that the child is having some difficulty breathing and may be experiencing respiratory distress. Respiratory distress is discussed in the section on respiratory care. Pulse rate. The normal pulse rate of a child is faster than an adult's normal rate. For a child younger than 1 year, palpate a brachial pulse, which is located halfway between the shoulder and the elbow on the inside of the upper arm or directly over the heart. High body temperature. Flushed, red skin, sweating, and restlessness often accompany high temperatures in children. You can often feel a high temperature just by touching the child's chest and head. A child's heart rate increases with each degree of temperature rise. Respiratory care. Neither adults nor children can tolerate a lack of oxygen for more than a few minutes before permanent brain damage occurs. It is important for you to open and maintain the airway and to ventilate adequately any child with a respiratory condition. Otherwise, the child may go into respiratory arrest, followed by cardiac arrest because of the lack of oxygen to the heart. This is a different situation than adults, who usually experience cardiopulmonary arrest as a result of a heart attack. Some of the specific causes of cardiopulmonary arrest in children include suffocation caused by the aspiration of a foreign body, infections of the airway such as croup and acute epiglottitis, sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, accidental poisonings, and injuries around the head and neck. This chapter covers each condition in detail. Treating respiratory emergencies in infants and children. You need four types of skills to treat respiratory emergencies in children: opening the airway, basic life support, suctioning, and the use of airway adjuncts. Opening the airway. When opening the airway of a child or an infant, use the same general techniques that you use for an adult patient. The head tilt chin lift maneuver can be used for children who have not sustained an injury to the neck or head. When using the head tilt chin lift maneuver on a child, be sure that you do not hyperextend the neck when you tilt the head back. Hyperextending a child's neck can occlude the airway. Use a neutral or slight sniffing position. You can place a folded towel under the child's shoulders to help maintain this position. If the possibility of injury to the head or neck exists, try the jaw thrust maneuver to open the airway. If the jaw thrust maneuver does not open the airway, use the head tilt chin lift maneuver because opening the airway is a top priority for an unresponsive patient. Basic life support. Because children are smaller than adults, you must use specific techniques when you perform cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, on children. There are special procedures for hand placement, compression pressure, and airway positioning. CPR for children 1 year of age to the onset of puberty is different from adult CPR in the following three ways. 1. If you are alone, without help, and no one has called EMS, perform 5 cycles or 2 minutes of CPR before activating the EMS system. 2. Use the heel of one hand or two hands to perform chest compressions, depending on the size of the child. 3. Compress the sternum at least 1/3 the depth of the chest, about 2 inches, 5 centimeters. CPR for infants, younger than 1 year, has the following 5 differences from adult CPR. 1. Check for responsiveness by tapping the infant's foot or gently shaking the shoulder. 2. Check the pulse by using the brachial pulse. 3. Use your middle and ring fingers to compress the sternum just below the nipple line. 4. Compress the sternum to a depth of at least 1/3 the depth of the chest, about 1.5 inches, 4 centimeters. 5. Give gentle rescue breaths using mouth-to-mouth and nose ventilations. Suctioning. To clear secretions, vomitus, or blood from a patient's airway, turn the patient on his or her side and use your gloved fingers to scoop out as much of the substance as possible. You can use suctioning, aspirating or sucking out fluid by mechanical means to remove the foreign substances that cannot be removed with your gloved fingers. Suctioning to open a blocked airway can be a life-saving procedure. The procedure used for suctioning infants and children is generally the same as for adults, with the following exceptions. 1. Use a tonsil tip or rigid tip to suction the mouth. Do not insert the tip any farther than you can see. 2. Use a flexible catheter to suction the nose of a child. Set the suction on low or medium power. 3. Use a bulb syringe to suction the nose of an infant. Remember that an infant can breathe only through the nose. 4. Never suction for more than 5 seconds at one time. 5. Try to ventilate and reoxygenate the patient before repeating the suctioning. For a complete description of how to use suctioning, review the material presented in Chapter 7, Airway Management, and Chapter 16, Childbirth. Airway adjuncts. An oral airway can maintain an open airway after you have opened the patient's airway by manual means. Use these steps to insert an oral airway in a child or an infant. 1. Select the proper size oral airway by measuring from the patient's earlobe to the corner of the mouth. 2. Position the patient's airway. If the emergency is medical, use the head tilt chin lift maneuver, avoiding hyperextension. If the patient has a traumatic injury, use the jaw thrust maneuver. 3. Depress the patient's tongue with 2 or 3 stacked tongue blades. Press the tongue forward and away from the roof of the mouth. 4. Follow the anatomic curve of the roof of the patient's mouth to slide the airway into place. 5. Be gentle. The mouths of children and infants are fragile. EMRs usually do not use nasal airways for children. If you have questions about using nasal airways in pediatric patients, check with your medical director. Mild partial airway obstruction. You can usually relieve a mild partial airway obstruction by placing the child on his or her back, supine, tilting the head, and lifting the chin in the head tilt chin lift maneuver. An airway blocked by an aspirated foreign object, for example, small toy, piece of candy, balloon, is a common occurrence in young children, particularly in children who are crawling. If the foreign object is only partially blocking the airway, the child will probably be able to pass some air around the object. You can remove the object if it is clearly visible in the mouth, and you can remove it easily. However, if you cannot see the object, or if you do not think you can remove it easily, do not attempt to remove it. as long as the child can still breathe air around the object. Sometimes trying to remove an object that is partially blocking the airway can result in a severe airway blockage, which is an extremely serious situation. Children with a partial mild airway obstruction should be transported to the emergency department. During treatment and transport, talk constantly to a child with a partially obstructed airway about what you are doing. Carrying on a conversation with a child oftentimes comforts the child and reduces the terror of having something stuck in the throat. The presence of a parent during transport can provide emotional support to both the parent and the child. The parent's presence can often reassure and calm the child. Judge each situation carefully. Not all parents are able to remain calm during such a serious situation. However, most of the time, parents are able to realize the seriousness of the situation, redirect their emotions, and work with you to reassure and calm the child. If you have oxygen available and are trained in its use, administer it by carefully placing the oxygen mask over the child's mouth and nose. Do not try to get an airtight seal on the mask. Hold it 1 or 2 inches, 3 to 5 centimeters away from the child's face. If you tell the child what you are doing with the oxygen and how it will make breathing easier, you may be able to calm and relax the child. Carefully monitor this critical situation to ensure that the mild obstruction does not become a severe obstruction. Severe, complete airway obstruction in children. A severe, complete airway obstruction is a serious emergency. A severe airway obstruction exists when the child has poor air exchange, increased breathing difficulty, a silent cough, the inability to speak, or no air movement because of an obstruction. You have only a few minutes to act before permanent brain damage occurs. Use the Heimlich maneuver, abdominal thrusts, because it provides enough energy to expel most foreign objects that could completely block a child's airway. The steps for relieving an airway obstruction in a conscious child, 1 year to the onset of puberty, are the same as for an adult patient. However, the anatomic differences between adults and children require that you make some adjustments in your technique. When opening the airway of a child or infant, tilt the head back just past the neutral position. Tilting the head too far back, hyperextending the neck, can actually obstruct the airway of a child or infant. If you are by yourself and a child with an airway obstruction becomes unresponsive, perform CPR for 5 cycles, about 2 minutes, before activating the EMS system. A skill performance sheet titled Child, Foreign Body Airway Obstruction is included for your review and practice. Complete or severe airway obstruction in infants. An infant younger than 1 year is very fragile. Infants' airway structures are very small and they are more easily injured than those of an adult. If you suspect an airway obstruction, first assess the infant to determine whether there is any air exchange. If the infant is crying, the airway is not completely obstructed. If no air is moving in or out of the infant's mouth and nose, suspect an obstructed airway. Find out what was happening when the episode of breathing difficulties began. Someone may have seen the infant put a foreign body into his or her mouth. To relieve an airway obstruction in a conscious infant, use a combination of back slaps and the chest thrust maneuver. Be sure you are holding the infant securely as you alternate the back slaps and chest thrusts. If there is no movement of air from the infant's mouth and nose, a sudden onset of severe breathing difficulty, a silent cough, or a silent cry, suspect a severe airway obstruction. To relieve a severe airway obstruction in an infant, use a combination of back slaps and chest thrusts. Review the following sequence until you can carry it out proficiently and automatically. To assist a conscious infant with a severe airway obstruction, perform the following steps. 1. Assess the infant's airway and breathing status. Determine that there is no air exchange. 2. Place the infant in a face-down position over your forearm and support your forearm with your thigh. Support the infant's head and neck with one hand and place the infant's head lower than the trunk. Use the heel of your hand and deliver 5 back slaps forcefully between the infant's shoulder blades. 3. Next, continuing to support the head, turn the infant face up by sandwiching the infant between your hands and arms. Rest the infant on his or her back with the head lower than the trunk. 4. Deliver 5 chest thrusts in the middle of the sternum. Use 2 fingers and deliver the thrusts firmly. 5. Repeat the series of back slaps and chest thrusts until the infant expels the foreign object or becomes unresponsive. 6. If the infant becomes unresponsive, continue with the following steps. 7. Ensure that EMS has been activated. 8. Begin CPR. Open the airway by using the head tilt chin lift maneuver. Look into the mouth for any foreign object. Use finger sweeps only if you can see a foreign object. Attempt to give one ventilation. If air does not go in, reposition the head and attempt another breath. If air still does not go in, begin chest compressions. See Chapter 8, Professional Rescuer CPR, for coverage of this part of the CPR sequence. 9. Continue these CPR steps until more advanced EMS personnel arrive. Note, if you are alone, administer CPR for 5 cycles, about 2 minutes, and then activate EMS. Recent studies have shown that administering chest compressions to an unresponsive patient increases the pressure in the chest, similar to administering chest thrusts, and may relieve an airway obstruction. Therefore, performing CPR on an infant who has become unresponsive has the same effect as administering chest thrusts on a conscious patient. Swallowed objects. Children often swallow small, round objects like marbles, beads, buttons, and coins. If these objects do not become airway obstructions, they usually pass uneventfully through the child and are eliminated in a bowel movement. However, sharp or straight objects, such as open safety pins, bobby pins, and bones, are dangerous if swallowed. Arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility because special instruments and techniques are required to locate and remove the object from the stomach and intestinal tract. Respiratory distress. Respiratory distress indicates that a child has a serious condition that requires immediate medical attention. Often, respiratory distress quickly leads to respiratory failure. You must be able to recognize the following signs of respiratory distress. 1. A breathing rate of more than 60 breaths per minute in infants. 2. A breathing rate of more than 30 to 40 breaths per minute in children. 3. Nasal flaring on each breath. 4. Retraction of the skin between the ribs and around the neck muscles. 5. Stridor, a high-pitched sound on inspiration. 6. Cyanosis of the skin. 7. Altered mental status. 8. Combativeness or restlessness. If you see that any of the listed signs are present, try to determine the cause. Support the child's respirations by placing the child in a comfortable position, usually sitting. Keep the child as calm as possible by letting a parent hold the child if practical. Prepare to administer oxygen if it is available and you are trained in its use. Monitor the child's vital signs and arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Respiratory failure arrest. Respiratory failure often results as respiratory distress proceeds. Many of the same factors that cause respiratory distress can cause respiratory failure. Characteristics of respiratory failure include the following conditions. 1. A breathing rate of fewer than 20 breaths per minute in an infant. 2. A breathing rate of fewer than 10 breaths per minute in a child. 3. Limp muscle tone. 4. Unresponsiveness. 5. Decreased or absent heart rate. 6. Weak or absent distal pulses. A child in respiratory failure is on the verge of experiencing respiratory and cardiac arrest. Immediately assess the child and take whatever steps are appropriate to support the patient. Support respirations by performing mouth-to-mask ventilations. Administer oxygen if it is available and you have been trained to use it. Begin chest compressions if the heart rate is absent or less than 60 beats per minute. Arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Continue to monitor the patient's vital signs and support the airway, breathing, and circulation functions as well as you can. Circulatory failure. The most common cause of circulatory failure in children is respiratory failure. Uncorrected respiratory failure in children can lead to circulatory failure, and uncorrected circulatory failure can lead to cardiac arrest. That is why it is so important for you to correct respiratory failure before it progresses to circulatory failure. However, this is not always possible, so you should learn the signs of circulatory failure and its treatment. An increased heart rate, pale or blue skin, and changes in mental status indicate circulatory failure. If the child or infant's heart rate is more than 60 beats per minute, your treatment should consist of completing the patient assessment sequence, supporting ventilations, administering oxygen if available, and observing vital signs for any changes. If the heart rate of a child or infant is less than 60 beats per minute, and there are signs of poor circulation, such as cyanosis, you should begin chest compressions and rescue breathing. Sudden illness and medical emergencies. Not many illnesses occur suddenly in young children, but most of the medical calls for children will involve sudden illnesses. It is important that you be able to recognize and treat these key pediatric illnesses. Altered mental status. Altered mental status in children can be caused by a variety of conditions, including low blood glucose level, poisoning, post-seizure state, infection, head trauma, and decreased oxygen levels. Sometimes you will be able to determine the cause of the altered mental status and take steps to correct the condition. For example, if the parent tells you that the child has diabetes and is experiencing insulin shock, you can administer glucose to increase the patient's blood glucose level. However, in many situations, you will not be able to determine the cause of the altered mental status and will have to treat the patient's symptoms. Complete your patient assessment, paying particular attention to any clues at the scene. Question any bystanders or family about the situation and try to get as much of the medical history as possible. Pay particular attention to the patient's initial vital signs. Recheck vital signs regularly to monitor any changes. Calm the patient and the patient's family. Be prepared to support the patient's airway, breathing, and circulation if needed. Place an unconscious patient in the recovery position to help keep an open airway and to aid in drainage of any secretions. Respiratory illnesses. A respiratory condition in an infant or child can range from a minor cold to complete blockage of the airway. Because infants breathe primarily through their noses, even a minor cold can cause breathing difficulties. The excessive mucus in the nose resulting from a cold makes it more difficult for an infant to breathe than for an older child who can breathe through both the nose and mouth. Although colds cause most common respiratory conditions in children, you should also be able to recognize and treat the three more serious conditions, asthma, croup, and epiglottitis. Asthma. A child who has asthma is usually already being treated for the condition by a physician and is taking a prescribed medication. In most situations, the child's parents call for assistance or transport only if the child is experiencing unusual breathing difficulties. Asthma can occur in children older than 1 year. It rarely occurs during the first year of life. It is caused by a spasm or constriction, narrowing, and inflammation of the smaller airways in the lungs, and usually produces a characteristic wheezing sound. Asthma attacks can range from mild to severe and can be triggered by many factors, including feathers, animal fur, tobacco smoke, pollen, respiratory infections, exercise, and even emotional situations. A child who is experiencing an asthma attack is in obvious respiratory distress. During a severe attack, you can often hear the characteristic wheezing on exhalation, even without a stethoscope. The child can inhale air without difficulty, but must labor to exhale the air. The effort to exhale is both frightening and tiring for the child. Your primary treatment consists of calming and reassuring both the parents and the child. Tell them everything possible is being done and encourage them to relax. Place the child in a sitting position to make breathing more comfortable. Ask the child to purse his or her lips as if blowing up a balloon. Tell the child to blow out with force while doing this. Breathing through pursed lips helps in two ways. Both parents and the child feel that something is being done, and this type of breathing relieves some of the internal lung pressures that cause the asthma attack. If a child has asthma medication but it has not been administered, help the parent administer the medication. The parents should contact the child's physician for further advice. If the child's physician is not available, arrange for prompt transport to the emergency department. Croup. Croup is an infection of the upper airway that occurs mainly in children who are between 6 months to 6 years. The lower throat swells and compresses, narrows the airway, resulting in a characteristic hoarse, whooping noise during inhalation and a seal-like barking cough. Croup occurs often in colder climates, during fall and winter, and is frequently accompanied by a cold. The child usually has a moderate fever and a croupy noise that has developed over time. The worst episodes of croup usually occur in the middle of the night. A lack of fright or anxiety in the child and his or her willingness to lie down are important signs for you to note because they can help you distinguish croup from epiglottitis. Epiglottitis is a more serious condition that is discussed in the next section. Although the signs and symptoms of croup are frightening for parents, it may not frighten the child. In many childhood emergencies, you must respond to the emotional needs and concerns of the parents as well as the medical needs of the child. Do not assume that croup is the cause of noisy breathing. Look to see if the child is choking on a toy, food, or a foreign object lodged in the airway. If the EMS unit is delayed, ask the parents to turn on the hot water in the shower and close the bathroom door. After the bathroom steams up, ask the parents to wait in there with the child until the EMS unit arrives. The moist, warm air relaxes the vocal cords and lessens the croupy noise. This effectively treats the child and reassures the parents. Have the parents contact the child's physician for further instructions or arrange for transport to an appropriate medical facility. Epiglottis. The third and most severe major respiratory condition is epiglottitis. Epiglottis is a severe inflammation of the epiglottis, the small flap that covers the trachea during swallowing. In this condition, the flap is so inflamed and swollen that air movement in the trachea is completely blocked. Epiglottitis usually occurs in children between ages 3 to 6 years. Because of the widespread vaccination of infants against the bacteria, Haemophilus influenza type B, that causes epiglottitis, the incidence of this disease is much less common now than in the past. This condition also occurs in adult patients who have not received the vaccination for Haemophilus influenza. While you conduct your initial examination, you may think the child has croup. However, because epiglottitis poses an immediate threat to life, you must be able to recognize the differences between croup and epiglottitis and know the signs and symptoms of epiglottitis. This is a very serious respiratory emergency. There is little that you can provide in the way of treatment except to make the child comfortable with as little handling as possible, keep everyone calm, administer oxygen if you have it available and have been trained to use it, and arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. You may consider letting a parent hold the child during transport if the emotional attitudes of the child and parent are appropriate. Drowning. Drowning is caused by submersion in water and initially causes respiratory arrest. It is the second most common cause of accidental death among children 5 years of age or younger in the United States. Although swimming pools, lakes, streams, and oceans present significant risks of drowning, ordinary water sources around the home increase the risk of drowning for young children. Children left unattended in washbowls or bathtubs for even a few minutes can drown. Buckets of water and toilet bowls also pose threats to young children who put their heads down to look into the water, lose their balance, fall in, and are unable to get out. The many sources of water around a home increase the chance that you may encounter a drowning situation when responding to a medical emergency involving a child. If you respond to a drowning situation, make sure that you do not put yourself in danger as you attempt a rescue. See Chapter 20, Vehicle Extrication and Special Rescue, for more information on water rescues. After the child is removed from the water, begin assessment and treatment. Signs and symptoms of drowning include lack of breathing and no pulse. Begin by assessing the airway, breathing, and circulation. Make sure the airway is clear of water. Turn the child to one side and allow the water to drain out of the mouth. Use suction if it is available. Start rescue breathing if necessary, and administer supplemental oxygen if it is available. If no pulse is present, start chest compressions. Because there is a chance that the patient has a cervical spine injury, stabilize the neck. To reduce the risk of hypothermia, dry the child with towels and cover the child with dry blankets or jackets. Arrange for prompt transport of the patient to an appropriate medical facility. A physician needs to evaluate all patients who have experienced submersion because serious respiratory conditions may develop several hours after submersion. Heat-related illnesses. Heat-related illnesses may range from relatively minor muscle cramps to vomiting, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke. The most dangerous heat-related illness in children is heat stroke. Any child who is in a closed, parked car on a hot day or in a poorly ventilated room and who has hot, dry skin may be experiencing heat stroke. This is a serious and potentially fatal condition that requires you to provide rapid treatment to cool the child and reduce his or her body temperature. Remove the child's clothing, sponge water over the child, and fan him or her to help lower the body temperature quickly. You may wrap the child in wet sheets, if they are available, to speed up the evaporation and cooling process, but do not let the child become chilled. Finally, be sure that you have arranged for rapid transport to an appropriate medical facility. See Chapter 13, Environmental Emergencies, for a more detailed description of heat stroke. High fever. Fevers occur quite commonly in children and can be caused by many different infections, especially ear and gastrointestinal infections. Because the temperature regulating mechanism in young children has not fully developed a very high temperature, 104 degrees Fahrenheit to 106 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 degrees Celsius to 41 degrees Celsius, can occur quickly, even with a relatively minor infection. Most children can tolerate temperatures as high as 104 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 degrees Celsius, but a high fever may require that the child be hospitalized so that the underlying cause can be discovered and treated. Your first step in treating a child with a high fever is to uncover the child so that body heat can escape. Layers of clothing or blankets retain body heat and can increase the patient's body temperature high enough to cause convulsions. About 10% of children between 1 and 6 years of age are susceptible to seizures brought on by high fevers. Remember that in attempting to reduce a high fever, you are treating only the symptom and not the source. A physician must see the child as soon as possible to determine the cause of the fever. If you encounter a child with a temperature above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, 40 degrees Celsius, take these steps to treat the fever symptoms. 1. Make certain the child is not wrapped in too much clothing or too many blankets. 2. Attempt to reduce the high temperature by undressing the child. 3. Fan the child to cool him or her down. 4. Protect the child during any seizure. Do not restrain the child's motion, and make certain that normal breathing resumes after each seizure. Seizures. Seizures, convulsions, can result from a high fever or from disorders such as epilepsy. See Chapter 10, Medical Emergencies. Seizures can vary in intensity from simple, momentary staring spells without body movements to generalized seizures in which the entire body stiffens and shakes severely. Although seizures can be frightening to parents, bystanders, and rescuers, they are not usually dangerous. During a seizure, a child becomes unconscious, the eyes roll back, the teeth become clenched, and the body shakes with severe jerking movements. Often, the child's skin becomes pale or turns blue. Sometimes the child has a loss of bladder and bowel control and soils his or her clothing. Seizures caused by a high fever usually last about 20 seconds. If a seizure occurs, place the child on a soft surface, sofa, bed, or rug, to protect the child from injury during the seizure. Reassure the child's parents who may be frightened by the seizure. If they become too emotional, ask them to leave the room. Carefully monitor the child's airway during and after the seizure. As an EMR, you can provide the following treatment for seizures. 1. Place the patient on the floor or a bed to prevent injury. 2. Maintain an adequate airway after the seizure ends. 3. Provide supplemental oxygen after the seizure if it is available and you are trained to use it. 4. Arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. 5. Continue to monitor the patient's vital signs and support the ABCs if necessary. 6. After the seizure is over, cool the patient if the patient has a high fever. Vomiting and diarrhea. Children are very susceptible to vomiting and diarrhea, which are usually caused by gastrointestinal infections. Prolonged vomiting and diarrhea may produce severe dehydration. The dehydrated child is lethargic and has very dry skin, which can be especially noticeable around the mouth and nose. Hospitalization may be required to replace fluids through the veins. If you suspect that a child may be dehydrated, arrange for transport to an appropriate medical facility. Abdominal pain. One of the most serious causes of abdominal pain in children is appendicitis. Although it can occur at any age, appendicitis is often seen in people who are between 10 and 25 years. A cramping pain usually starts in the belly button area of the abdomen. Within a few hours, the pain moves to the right lower quadrant of the abdomen, becoming steady and more severe. Usually the child is nauseated, has no appetite, and occasionally will vomit. Because there are several potential causes of abdominal pain, including appendicitis, do not try to make a diagnosis in the field. Even physicians may find it difficult to diagnose the cause of abdominal pain. A good rule for you to follow is to treat every child with a sore or tender abdomen as an emergency and arrange for transport to an appropriate medical facility for an appropriate diagnosis. Poisoning. Young children are curious and often like to sample the contents of brightly colored bottles or cans, looking for something good to eat or drink. However, many common household items contain poisonous substances. The two most common types of poisonings in children are caused by ingestion and absorption. Ingestion. An ingested poison is taken by mouth. A child who has ingested a poison may have chemical burns, odors, or stains around the mouth and be experiencing nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, or diarrhea. Later symptoms may include abnormal or decreased respirations, unconsciousness, or seizures. If you believe a child has ingested a poisonous substance, do the following. 1. Try to identify what the child has swallowed. Attempt to estimate the amount ingested and send the bottle or container along with the child to the emergency department. 2. Gather any spilled tablets if the child swallowed tablets from a medicine bottle and replace them in the bottle so they can be counted. The emergency physician may then be able to determine how many tablets the child has taken. 3. Contact your local poison control center if transportation to an appropriate medical facility is delayed. The poison control center will need to know the following information: age of the patient, identification of the poison, weight of the patient, estimated quantity of the poison taken. 4. Follow the directions provided by the poison control center. You may need to perform the following actions: dilute the poison by giving the child large amounts of water. Administer activated charcoal if it is available and you have been trained in its use. The usual dose for pediatric patients is 12.5 to 25 grams. 5. Monitor the child's breathing and pulse closely. This is a critical step, and you must be prepared to provide emergency care, including rescue breathing and CPR. 6. Arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility for examination by a physician. Absorption. Poisoning by absorption occurs when a poisonous substance enters the body through the skin. A child who has absorbed a poison may have localized symptoms, such as skin irritation or burning, or may have systemic signs and symptoms of the poisoning, such as nausea, vomiting, dizziness, and shock. If you believe a child has absorbed a poisonous substance, perform the following actions. 1. Ensure that the child is no longer in contact with the poisonous substance. 2. Protect yourself from exposure to the poison. Call for specially trained personnel if indicated. 3. Remove the child's clothing if you think it is contaminated. 4. Brush off any dry chemical. After you have removed all dry chemical, wash the child with water for at least 20 minutes. 5. Wash off any liquid poisons by flushing with water for at least 20 minutes. 6. Try to identify the poison and send any containers with the child to the emergency department. 7. Monitor the child for any changes in respiration and pulse. Be prepared to administer rescue breathing or CPR if needed. 8. If the child has vomited, save a sample in a clean container and send it with the patient to the hospital if you can perform this action without detracting from the care of the patient. 9. Arrange transport to an appropriate medical facility for examination by a physician. See Chapter 11, Poisoning and Substance Abuse, for additional information on emergency treatment of poisoning. Sudden Infant Death Syndrome. A condition that is frequently mistaken for child abuse is sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, also called crib death or sudden unexpected infant death, SUID. It is the sudden and unexpected death of an apparently healthy infant. SIDS usually occurs in infants between the ages of 3 weeks and 7 months. The infants are usually found dead in their cribs. Currently, no adequate scientific explanation exists for SIDS. These deaths are not the result of smothering, choking, or strangulation. SIDS deaths often remain unexplained, even after a complete and thorough autopsy. You can imagine the shock and grief felt by parents who find their apparently healthy infant dead in bed. Your actions and words can help relieve their feelings of remorse and guilt. If the infant is still warm, begin CPR and continue until help arrives. Infant CPR is described in Chapter 7, Airway Management, and Chapter 8, Professional Rescuer CPR. In many cases, the infant has been dead several hours and the body is cold and lifeless. Do not mistake the large bruise-like blotches on the infant's body for signs of child abuse. The blotches are caused by the pooling of the infant's blood after death. Sometimes you may find a small amount of bloody foam on the infant's lips. If the child is obviously dead, follow the protocol in your community for the management of deceased patients. Know your local guidelines for the management of SIDS. Remember that the parents could do nothing to prevent the death. Be compassionate and supportive during this tragic situation. Pediatric trauma. Trauma remains the number one killer of children. Each year, many young lives are lost because of accidental injury, particularly motor vehicle crashes. Treat an injured child as you would treat an injured adult, but remember the following differences. 1. A child cannot communicate symptoms as well as an adult. 2. A child may be shy and overwhelmed by adult rescuers, especially those in uniform, so it is important to develop a good relationship quickly to reduce the child's fear and anxiety. 3. You may have to adapt materials and equipment to the child's size. 4. A child does not show signs of shock as early as an adult, but can progress into severe shock quickly. Patterns of injury. The type of trauma a child experiences, the type of activity causing the injury, and the child's anatomy affect the pattern of injuries sustained by the child. Motor vehicle crashes produce different patterns of injuries depending on whether the patient was using a seatbelt, whether the patient was strapped into a car seat, and whether an airbag inflated in the crash. Unrestrained patients tend to have more head and neck injuries. Restrained passengers often sustain head injuries, spinal injuries, and abdominal injuries. Children struck while riding a bicycle often have head, spinal, abdominal, and extremity injuries. The use of bicycle helmets greatly reduces the number and severity of head injuries. Pedestrians who are struck by a vehicle often sustain chest and abdominal injuries with internal bleeding, injuries to the thighs, and head injuries. Falls from a height or diving accidents tend to cause head and spinal injuries and extremity injuries. Burns are a major cause of injuries to children. Sports activities cause a wide variety of injuries, depending on the type of sports activity. By learning some of the basic patterns of injury, you can anticipate the injuries you may find when carefully examining pediatric patients. If the child has been struck by a motor vehicle, look for the common types of injuries. Major trauma in children usually results in multiple system injuries. No matter what the cause of injury, your first priority is always to check the patient's ABCs. Stop severe bleeding, treat the patient for shock, and proceed with the full body assessment described in Chapter 9, Patient Assessment, to determine the extent of any other injuries. The full body assessment is a hands-on procedure. A complete examination is especially important because a child cannot always communicate symptoms. Involve the child in the physical examination as much as possible. Ask the child simple questions. Complete the full body assessment even if the patient is too young to understand what is happening. Then stabilize all injuries you find. Splint suspected fractures, bandage wounds, and immobilize suspected spinal injuries. If your patient has head lacerations, remember that the generous blood supply to the scalp can result in severe bleeding. Treat these wounds with direct pressure and appropriate bandaging techniques. See Chapter 14, Bleeding, Shock, and Soft Tissue Injuries for a review of effective bandaging techniques. Traumatic shock in children. Children show shock symptoms much more slowly than adults, but they progress through the stages of shock quickly. An injured child displaying obvious shock symptoms such as cool, clammy skin, a rapid, weak pulse, or rapid or shallow respirations is already experiencing severe shock. It is vital that you learn to recognize and treat shock quickly. Review the signs and symptoms of shock in Chapter 14, Bleeding, Shock, and Soft Tissue Injuries. Immediate treatment of an injured child experiencing shock includes controlling external bleeding, keeping the child warm, and administering oxygen if it is available. Children who show signs of shock should be transported as soon as possible to an emergency department. Seizures are relatively common in children who have sustained a serious head injury. Be prepared to manage this condition by maintaining the airway and protecting the child from further injury. The greatest dangers to any patient who has sustained trauma are airway obstruction and hemorrhage. When caring for an injured child, the most important actions you should perform are as follows. Open and maintain the airway. Control bleeding. Arrange for prompt transport to an appropriate medical facility. Car seats and children. The impact of mandatory child restraint laws means that EMRs are finding more children still strapped into car seats after motor vehicle crashes. You should become familiar with child restraint seats and understand how to gain access to children restrained in them. If you find a child properly restrained in a car seat, leave the child in the car seat until the ambulance arrives. In many situations, a child can be secured in the seat removed from the vehicle, and both the seat and the child transported together to the hospital. Child abuse. Child abuse is not limited to any ethnic, social, or economic group, or to families with any particular level of education. Suspect child abuse if the child's injuries do not match the story you are told about how the injuries occurred. Child abuse is often masked as an accident. The abused or battered child may have many visible injuries, all at different stages of healing. The child may appear to be withdrawn, fearful, or even hostile. Be concerned if the child refuses to discuss how an injury occurred. Occasionally, the child's parents or caretaker will reveal a history of several accidents in the past. Treat the child's injuries and, if you are suspicious that this may be a case of child abuse, ensure the safety of the child. Make sure that the child receives transport to an appropriate medical facility. If the parents object to having the child examined by a physician, summon law enforcement personnel and explain your concerns to them. The safety of the child is your foremost concern in these situations. Neglect is also a form of child abuse. Children who are neglected are often dirty or too thin or appear developmentally delayed because of a lack of stimulation. You may observe such children when you are making calls for unrelated problems. The parents of an abused child need help, and the child may need protection from the parents' future actions. Handle each situation in a non-judgmental manner. Know whom you need to contact, usually the emergency department staff or law enforcement personnel, and report any instances of suspected child abuse. Sexual assault of children. Sexual abuse occurs in children as well as adults. It may occur in both male and female infants, young children, and adolescents. In addition to sexual assault, the child may have been beaten and may have other serious injuries. If you suspect sexual assault has occurred, obtain as much information as possible from the child and any witnesses. Realize that the child may be hysterical or unwilling to talk, especially if the abuser is a brother or sister, parent, or family friend. Providing a caring approach to these children is extremely important, and take appropriate action to shield them from onlookers. All victims of sexual assault should receive transport to an appropriate medical facility. Sexual assault is a crime. Cooperate with law enforcement officials during their investigation. Emergency medical responder debriefing. As an EMR, you will respond to many calls that involve children. These calls tend to produce strong emotional reactions. At times, you may experience a feeling of helplessness when an innocent child is seriously injured or gravely ill. An ill or injured child may remind you of your own children. You may feel especially angry or helpless when you suspect the neglect or abuse of a child. After you have completed your treatment of the patient and transferred the responsibility for care to other EMS personnel, you may need to talk about your frustrations with a counselor or with another member of your department. After a major incident or an especially emotional incident involving children, it may be helpful for you to set up a critical incident stress debriefing session. Although you cannot change the types of traumatic events you will see, you can use your department's resources to work through your feelings about these events. By attending a debriefing session, you can express your feelings, learn some coping strategies, and maintain a healthy approach to future calls.